I grew up in a small town. My dad was the mayor and the newspaper editor. And so I grew up getting very, very involved in government, community issues, political issues, became a news junkie at a very, very early age. Just out of law school, my husband ran for the legislature, was elected, was one of the youngest members ever, and we were introduced to statewide politics. He served 14 years, and just as he was getting out, I think I literally stumbled into government and became a statewide office holder and was that for 10 years. Left government after 10 years, having seen the difficulty that businesses and public officials have working together, started a company, Strategic Partnerships, to help the partnerships between the public and the private sector, and that was goodness, 16 years ago now.
What I want to ask is if you can just sort of describe briefly for us how government usually does business. I know it's going to vary widely from department to department, agency to agency, state to state, but if you can just give us kind of a broad overview of how a government entity usually goes about doing business.
Okay, let me talk about in the past, because for the last 2 years, that has been changing radically. But in the past, government would outsource certain services, certain functions. Government has always bought trillions of dollars annually from the private sector. It could be goods, it could be services, but there's always been a lot of commercial contracting back and forth. The new trend is what we call the public-private partnerships, and that is not privatizing or outsourcing. It's a whole new model to partner the public and the private sectors.
Why the change? I mean, why change the way that the government had been doing business? You said trillions of dollars being purchased.
Right.
What's wrong with that?
Well, the Great Recession happened. What we are looking at today is government at every jurisdictional level is out of money. Public officials, with their budgets cut and they've already reduced staff, they are at bare bones throughout this country at every jurisdictional level. They have no money to repair roads, to check on bridges. Many cities have taken bankruptcy. It's a whole new paradigm. So government does not have money to maintain our infrastructure, and they are being forced to turn to the private sector for capital.
You're saying government have very tight budgets, shrinking budgets, not able to do the things they want to do. How does turning to a private partnership make that possible, though?
The private sector has always been very interested in contracting with government for many reasons. First of all, government contracts are large. Government contracts are stable. They feel they've got a good partner. That partner's not going to go away. And so the private sector is perfectly happy to bring capital, to bring funding to the table, and to propose a business model whereby they would build, design, finance, and operate facilities, roads, toll roads, whatever, for government. And government would own those assets, but would allow the return on the investment for the private sector partner to come from a long-term operational agreement of some sort.
So is the government, in this kind of arrangement, does the government make any money off of this? I mean, let's just take a toll road, for example. If under sort of the old way of doing things, the government had built a toll road and then took those revenues into itself, now those revenues are going to the private company. So how does...
Or perhaps they're split.
They're split.
There's all kinds of arrangements. But let me give you an example that I think all of your listeners would understand. Let's look at the DFW airport. There was a parcel of land that they gave to a private sector company to build a hotel. And that hotel is very strategically situated. It's always full. And the revenues from that hotel are split between the private sector company that built that hotel and the airport. So it's an ongoing stream of revenue back to the public entity. But the public entity put up the land, the private sector put up the capital to build it, and it's been a wonderful working relationship for decades.
Tell me a little bit about what makes a good collaboration then?
I think it's interesting to note that Canada, Europe, many, many other countries have been doing these public-private partnerships, which are called P3s. Very commonly. They've been doing those for decades. They're new in America. And so it's real important that we do it right and that we learn from their mistakes and we look at best practices. So it's a really good question. What makes a good collaboration? Well, certainly an understanding of what a P3 is supposed to be. It's supposed to be a contractual agreement whereby the private sector partner brings capital to the table. The public sector partner oversees the entire contract, that there are benchmarks, but the risk transfers from the public sector to the private sector. And normally there is an ongoing relationship that sometimes lasts one or maybe two decades. It's a very slow return on their investment.
You said important to learn from mistakes of some other places that have done P3s, these public-private partnerships. Can you talk about what some of those common mistakes have been then in these arrangements or times when things did not work well?
One that everyone would remember is the Trans-Texas Corridor. Remember that some of our leadership wanted to build a very, very large superhighway. And I think that failed because there simply has to be a buy-in from all the stakeholders. There has to be total transparency. The public, the taxpayers, want to know, what are you doing? This is my tax dollars at work. Certainly, there was going to be my property involved here in that one. It never got started off right, and it ended very quickly.
I mean, one of the, I think, concerns that comes up when people hear about public-private partnerships is what private entities are benefiting from this. In other words, you know, is it an elected official's brother-in-law? Is it, you know, maybe a business where they used to work and now they're in government? So they're, I mean, it seems like it's ripe for cronyism or favoritism.
Right.
And
you know,
there may not be a way to necessarily know if that's at play or not.
I will tell you, after living in this world for the last 16 years, political leaders try very hard to stay as far away from procurement and contractual outsourcing and privatizing as they possibly can. By and large, this is a very fair process. You normally have long-term public employees handling the process, and in 99% of the time, they are scared to death of making a mistake. They are so afraid they will favor one vendor or one contractor over another that they almost are not open with any of them.
Well, let's talk about kind of the cultures that are at play here. The culture of a for-profit business versus the culture of a government entity, those are traditionally fairly different cultures. Is it hard to get them to kind of on the same page for projects like this?
The big hurdle to overcome is the culture. The public sector mindset and culture and environment is so totally different from the private sector. If you take a public official, first of all, they don't understand sales quotas. They don't ever think about margins. I mean, they are not a for-profit entity. And those individuals who live in the government world are so totally different. It's hard for them to understand these private sector people, and it's very hard for private sector sales executives to understand public sector officials.
So how do you get them to understand each other?
You have to explain, here's the mindset. Here's the environment they live in. Here's how their careers get forwarded or not. And you take a public sector person who's working procurement, it's all black and white to them. They are going to go by the book. They are normally inflexible. So when you get a really good P3 working, you've got to somehow make a government person understand that we do have to be more innovative. We have to be more flexible. We have to learn to respect this very strange private sector salesperson I'm having to deal with. And the reverse is true. We have to make the private sector person respect the public sector official.
You said right now sort of the tide is turning a little bit and this is becoming more common. I mean, is this something that you think really can catch on widely, given the cultural differences and the differences in experience and opinion that people are bringing to these tables?
I think we must hope that it can catch on, it can be successful, because if we don't learn to do public-private partnerships well, I don't know how we're going to repair our roads, fix our bridges, build the vertical infrastructure that we need. These public-private partnerships are doing everything from cybersecurity to horizontal construction. I mean, here in Austin, we're looking at probably building the courthouse with a public-private partnership. The city is trying to understand everything they can about public-private partnerships because they know that going forward, we have lots of public projects that we need to launch, but there is no funding for it.
Are there certain kinds of project? I mean, you've mentioned, you know, roads, bridges, courthouses, there are all kinds of different things. Are there certain kinds of projects that lend themselves to this kind of collaboration better than others?
Well, let me tell you some of the more common ones that are going very, very well. Many universities are welcoming developers and construction companies onto their campuses saying, we need more student housing. And we just simply don't have the funds to build a new building. So come on to our campus. We'll give you the land. You build the dorm or the student housing. And maybe we'll develop retail around it and we will split the retail. But we'll let you maintain and operate that facility that you build over the next 15 or 16 years. But we, the university, will own it long term. Those are working extremely well. That's a wonderful example. Transportation projects, I think you're going to see in Texas over the next 10 years, every major transportation project will be a P3. And you can talk to the officials at the Texas Department of Transportation. They will tell you the same thing. They do not have the funding. It's not going to come. The legislature doesn't have it to give to them. The federal government is cutting back on the funding coming into the state. It has to be a public-private partnership. And the private sector is going to have to learn to bring their capital and understand public officials and structure engagements that work for both sides.
Is there a P3 project underway in Central Texas right now that people might recognize or say, oh, I didn't realize that was one of these? Is there one
sure
you can describe right
let
now?
Let me tell you, probably one of the most successful ones that people don't even think about is Texas Online. You can go right now and renew all your licenses and so forth online. Well, let me tell you how that partnership came about. The state's Department of Information Services, big agency that controls all the technology decisions, outsourced or partnered, which whatever you want to call it, it is truly a P3, but with a company called NIC USA, who came in, built a portal, runs the portal, administers everything, makes it work for all of the agencies, and splits the revenue back with the state. And it works extremely well, and all taxpayers benefit from that.
So I want to bring up an example. You're talking about technology, and I think people might remember a few years back when the state of Texas contracted with IBM to do some management of data, some consolidation of data, and that did not work out well at all. IBM wound up leaving the project. It wasn't getting done. Can you walk us through what went wrong with that one?
Sure.
Because when it started, everybody thought it was going to be great, and it failed.
Well, the state actually had that consolidated data center for 10 years, and it had been successful. And the contract came up for rebid, and the Department of Information Resources put out a new contract. And really and truly probably did a lot of things wrong. P3s were very, very new at that time. There'd been the learning curve was straight up, but there was very little transparency. In other words, the state agency people did not want to talk to competitors. They didn't want to, but they were so afraid they would help one and not help the other. And so there was almost no communication. They simply put out an RFP and said, come and bid if you would like to run this consolidated data center. IBM came in, bid about $600 million lower than the next bidder, and got the contract. And IBM walked into a situation they had not anticipated. They didn't know enough about it, and they found it was going to cost a lot more. The state who was overseeing that was having problems with, the culture clash as much as anything. But it didn't work. It simply didn't work. And the state had to take that project back. And both parties lost money. And it was a failed project. And that's the reason I said we need to hope that we can all understand these, and that our public officials and our private sector companies that would put the capital up, that they understand what makes them good, what makes them fail, because the taxpayers are going to either benefit or not from it.
I think when people hear, you know, government, private sector, privatization, outsourcing, all of these words together, they start thinking politically, even if it's not necessarily a political issue. Does this have sort of politics woven into it in any way? Or are there, you know, if an administration is either conservative or leaning or more liberal leaning, are they more inclined to be, you know, favorable to this? How does politics play into this?
I don't think it's a Democrat or Republican issue. And I think both sides, you have Rahm Emanuel, who was formerly with Obama as his chief of staff, and now is a mayor of Chicago and is literally leading the charge for P3s. And you would normally think that a Democratic administration would not want to do that, that they would want to keep the jobs in government. But I think Rahm Emanuel is a visionary. He has seen we have so much we have to do. We don't have the money. We have no other option.
Well, you said keep the jobs in government, which makes me think, I wonder if another concern about P3s is that it means job loss.
I think it doesn't mean job loss, but I think that is a misconception. There are a lot of misconceptions. First of all, most public officials fight a public-private partnership if they don't understand it, because they don't want to lose those government jobs. But what happens is if you outsource or privatize or do a P3, those jobs remain. Sometimes those people are transferred on to the payroll of the private sector partner. But someone still has to do the work. What you gain through a P3 is you gain the private sector expertise. You get a company who does nothing but this. And so you get more efficiency, more productivity, more cutting edge technology that deals with it, and higher trained people. But they are always, those jobs are going to remain. They're not going to displace government workers. There will not be a loss of jobs by the P3s by any stretch of the imagination.
Mary Scott Neighbors is author of Collaboration Nation, How Public-Private Ventures Are Revolutionizing the Business of Government. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you.